always wanted to direct, but I guess I was terrified to do it. And at the same time, I knew that I could only do something that I had a point of view about, the story I wanted to tell and write. And I always, in the back of my mind, thought, well, Clint Eastwood waited till he was 40. So as long as I don't wait too long, at least look what he did. So it was about 40 years old that I just said, okay, I got to do it.
That was Bradley Cooper, the star, co-writer, and director of the hit new movie A Star Is Born. So it opened last weekend, and, you know, from all indications, they say that it's going to be nominated for a ton of Oscars. You know, I have to tell you, I saw it with my wife, and as good as Lady Gaga was in this particular movie, and she was very good, I think Bradley Cooper's performance was the performance that was the knockout. I thought the guy was incredible.
He'll be nominated. He won't win.
Well, you know,
the question is whether he'll get a directorial nomination, which the Academy may want to do for him. I mean, I think this is a Hollywood movie, and we haven't seen a Hollywood kind of a movie like this in a long time. So I think older voters and younger voters have something to like get excited about here.
Well, you told me, Bill McCut. By the way, this is Neil Rosen, along with Bill Bragoli.
I hear crickets.
And Bill McCuddy.
I hear crickets when I perform.
So, you know, Bill McCuddy said to me before I saw this movie, he saw it the day before I did, that, you know, I hope you see it in a theater where, like, it's unbelievable.
I saw it at Dolby Theater.
So did I. The chairs vibrate. The sound is unbelievable. It's almost as if you're, like, in the beginning, it starts out with Bradley Cooper, like, at some kind of rock concert. You feel like you're at a rock concert. It's crazy. But sound technical specs notwithstanding, it is a Hollywood movie, Bill. You're right. And I liked it better than the Streisand Kris Kristofferson vehicle.
I thought they were very similar in a lot of ways. A lot of people say that he's doing Kristofferson as an impression, but he's obviously, if you've seen the movie, or even if you haven't, I'm not giving anything away, he's doing a Sam Elliott impression. That's, you know, what he cops to, because that's his brother, and they say he's trying to steal his voice.
Did you notice that Sam Elliott drives a Dodge Ram pickup truck?
What, is that like a promotional tie-in?
Well, he does the voiceovers for the Dodge Ram commercials. He's the voice.
He's also, Neil, the guy that does Beef. It does a body good.
You know, so Bradley Cooper, I just thought he was terrific. I mean, there is a plot point in the movie where Sam Elliott says, "Why did you steal my voice?" And Bradley Cooper,
They're brothers in the film.
He said, "The voice that I did, I was kind of just trying to emulate Sam Elliott's voice." But Sam Elliott looks like a pretty much odds-on favorite to get an Oscar nomination for that.
Did you read the whole story about Cooper getting into that voice and how he had to slouch his body, and it took him a month and he couldn't do that voice unless he was curled up sort of slouchy, and then he learned how to eventually do it while he could stand straight up? There's a lot of backstory here that's really interesting. A lot of people say, you know, this is great that he did it. You know, Clint Eastwood had the rights with Beyonce, dropped the ball, Beyonce got pregnant. Bradley Cooper went to Eastwood and said, "I want to make this movie instead of you," and had to go to Warner Brothers, who would listen to his pitch, but weren't ever going to let him be a first-time director. And at the end of, like, I think a two-hour pitch, they caught Cooper fever and gave him $38 million. Mm.
So, you know, apparently what I read was that Bradley Cooper was somewhere and Lady Gaga was singing La Vie en Rose, and that's what sold Bradley Cooper on putting Lady Gaga.
Then he went to her house in Malibu, and they sang together. They sat at the piano, and then he's got that video that he showed everybody. Here's Lady Gaga doing this song with me. And anyway, it's a cool movie. It's in theaters now, and we all recommend it.
We're joined by documentarians or filmmakers, Jeffree Star and Richard Mirren. So we're joined by documentarians / filmmakers. I guess that's the same thing in some regard. Jeffree Star and Richard Mirren.
Don't say Mirren. He's not related to Helen Mirren. Everyone makes that mistake.
And their movie is a documentary called For the Birds. And why don't you guys tell us about your movie?
Thanks for having us.
We'll change that.
Sorry?
We'll change that.
Yeah,
your zeal
say
for being here.
Thank you now. Okay. Wait.
Okay. Hold your applause till the end.
Yeah. So this is a feature documentary about a lady who lives with 200 pet ducks, chickens, geese, and turkeys in and around her house. And
by
her,
choice.
By choice, yes. By hatching. And her husband is starting to grow tired of all these birds. And then an animal rescue group comes in to try to help take the birds off of her hands. And that's where the story starts. And then over the course of 5 years, it twists and turns and escalates into a story about a marriage and about whether we can change ourselves.
Is she breaking any laws? Do the local officials get involved and say, you're not supposed to have this many animals on your property?
Yeah, that becomes a lot of the drama of the first sort of act of the film, is this push and pull of, can she have these birds? What are her rights in the situation? What are the birds' rights in the situation? What do the birds need to be happy?
Reading about the film, it says that she started out with, what, two ducks? Yeah.
That's how it always starts, Neil.
And, one duckling, yes.
Okay,
one
so... Duck. Yeah. What's all right, I guess without sounding too demeaning, what's the matter with this woman?
She is wants, this like hoarding?
That she wants 200 like, and they're all bird, obviously for the birds.
Yeah.
It's not like a cow or a pig. They're all bird. Yeah. What's the matter with this woman that she wants to keep 200 plus birds in her house?
I think she's a big animal lover, and both she and her husband both had dogs and cats before this one duckling wandered onto their yard one day, and they both took in the duckling and raised this duckling and thought it was a good idea to get a few more ducklings to be friends with this one, and then it started to get a little bit out of hand across 10 years, and we actually have all the home movies from this family over the course of that time, so we're able to tell that story from the very first duckling all the way through the present day.
How did you find out about this, and what made you, when you found out about it, say this is film worthy of making a movie about this?
So it actually started as a senior project in college. Jeff and I both went to Yale together, and we're studying documentary, and for my senior project I wanted to do a story about animal rescue. I'd been interested in animal rights and questions about human-animal relationships. And so I volunteered at this animal sanctuary in Woodstock, New York. And while I was volunteering there, they happened to hear about this lady and all her birds and went to go check it out. And I went with them on the very first visit. So I started filming from the very beginning.
And what's the head count? How many duck, how many geese, how many chickens do you have?
It starts out with about 200 chickens, ducks, geese, and turkeys, all told. Mm-hmm. And
Ducks and chickens.
Yeah.
And
I feel awful. Yeah. I should say we're at the Hampton Film Festival, obviously, and this is the 1770 House Hotel that we're doing this interview in, and I ordered some pâté, and I had no idea you guys were coming over. So I feel bad about that, but you don't have to eat it. So did she originally think she was going to raise and sell these things, and then she just couldn't, or she always wanted to just keep them?
I think it was mostly a companionship sort of situation.
Is she still with her husband, or would that be giving too much away?
That'd be giving too much
away.
Isn't it like...
We'll duck that question.
How did you gain her trust? When you guys walk up there, hey, we want to do a film about you and your chickens.
So I first met her through the sanctuary, but shortly after, Jeffrey and I went to visit her and her husband to just spend time with them and interview them and walk around their property and just get to know them as people. So it was just important to establish independent relationships and just have curiosity about them as people, and I think they were trusting.
Isn't it kind of like hip now to like raise chickens? That's like a whole thing that I saw a thing on TV or something.
Are you raising any in your Upper East Side apartment?
No, I don't raise chickens, you know what I mean? But so we're talking to Michael Dweck,
yep,
the director and producer of The Last Race, a documentary, mm-hmm, on stock, not only stock car racing, but the last surviving stock car racetrack in the United States, which is here in Long Island, mm-hmm, if I'm not mistaken, in Riverhead.
Very close to where we're sitting right now. I mean, comparatively, you could go to a lot of festivals and not be this close to the very place we're talking about.
Pardon my ignorance, but
we always
I'm not
do.
I'm not a race car guy. Mm-hmm. Define like a stock car to me as a stock car race as opposed to, let's say, a Daytona 500 race, mm-hmm. or like what would classify as a stock car?
Well, a stock car is supposed to be stock, meaning it's you take it off the showroom floor, and you race it as is in its original condition.
Like so a Firebird, or it could be a Dodge Dart, or anything.
That's how it started.
That's how it started.
And there was a little cheating, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, that's what's involved now. So now you have this racetrack in Riverhead is the last racetrack that races stock cars. These are original. These are Cadillacs. The cars have to weigh 4,200 pounds. That's the rule. And this is the last track.
Not a pound more, not a pound less, or at least
more,
that?
More, no problem. Less,
right.
Not legal.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So you have, so those are Cadillacs, Eldorados, Lincoln Continentals, Chevy Impalas, that's it.
Stuff they don't really make
anymore.
Cars are
from the 60s to early 70s.
Wow.
And that's it. After that, they're too light.
And there's an audience for that that shows up and watches it?
2,000 people that come every week to root for their
no kidding.
Driver. So you have these guys that find these cars in a junkyard, typically. And the guys, the drivers, they're usually tow truck operators or grease monkeys. And they look for these cars. They find them. You have to take off the body panels. You weld in a frame of, you know, 2-inch tubing. So
a roll cage, basically.
Yeah. And then you put the panels back on again, so it's stock. The engine has to remain the same. The drive shaft, the transmission has to stay the same.
Amazing.
There's no stick shift in it. That's all taken out. And then you race. So nothing flammable, no windshield.
What do you mean there's no stick shift in it?
No, this is just an all-out brawl. This is the bull ring. So it's
but
a quarter of a mile.
You have to shift the car unless it's an automatic.
No, it's a one-gear automatic.
Okay.
So you have guys that are going 100 miles an hour, 30 cars in a quarter of a mile track, making contact. And the reason racing started, you can make full contact. The NASCAR now, in cup racing, if you make contact, you'll have a problem in the pits and a lawsuit. And these guys, you can make full contact. So it's called rubbing is the terminology.
So you could bang them off.
Oh, it's all that. It's pushing, banging.
But it's not demo derby because it would turn in, there'd be no race. They would just, everybody would be
correct.
Running into each other. So there's a fine line these guys go between going 100 miles an hour and not getting into a total accident?
They're like physicists. They know exactly what they're doing. They're so experienced. They know these cars really well. They work on them every single night of the year. Not just the summer when they race. Straight through the winter, they're working on that car every single night
so
of the
it's,
year.
So, as Bill said, it's not demolition derby, but are some cars, is the aim, like, I'm going to bang this guy off the track or mess up?
Well, it depends what happened the week before.
Interesting.
There's a lot of that.
So this storylines.
Since this is the last
storyline.
Surviving stock car, first of all, how many miles to win the race? How many laps around the track?
Typically 20 laps. It takes about 12 minutes. It's
okay.
Pretty quick.
Wow.
And
it's pretty quick and pretty crazy.
So how many heats in a night? How many?
They'll probably be, it depends on the week, but typically there'll be trials first. So it'll be like 3 heats of trials and then the final race. And then there's like 6 divisions. The division I concentrated on was called Blunderbuss. These are the original stock cars. That's what I'm interested in. I wasn't really that interested in the modified cars, the cars that you can buy, you know, in a kit that cost $200,000.
Now this is the last surviving one in New York State?
It's the last surviving racetrack on Long Island. There used to be 40. It's the last surviving racetrack that races original street stocks in the country.
So what happened to stock car racing? If there were 40, did it just grow out of, just fall out of favor with the...
development, the land became
they're all a gap now.
Too many people out here.
So Starbucks.
Race car tracks like on the West Coast, was it Laguna Seca or something? Now
that's right.
All condos.
It's a common problem. I mean, I was raised on Long Island. I was raised about 60 miles west of here, and I was raised next to a racetrack in a town called Freeport. And that was the first racetrack in the entire country. It was a stadium. It's called Freeport Stadium. They had boxing during the week, and then they had between stock car racing on the 2 days in the week, they had boxing, you know, out for the town. But for me, I used to go every Tuesday and Saturday. My parents never missed it when I was 3 years old until I went to college, and that was what we did. I rooted for my heroes, and one of my heroes actually coming. I just saw him in the street. A guy I used to watch race when he was 16. Is racing in Riverhead, and he's actually in the film, and I had no idea until he just told me what his little stage name was.
How long you been working on the film, and what made you get, how'd you get interested in this whole thing? This
Well, because I was raised next to a track, and Costco came and paved it over. That pissed
Costco.
Me off. That pissed me off to no end. And then there was only Islip and Riverhead were left, and then Islip was also paved over for a shopping mall. So then I decided, I'm a fine art photographer. I decided my next museum exhibition was going to be this racetrack. So I camped out there for 5 years. Every weekend, 23 weeks a year, and made that my studio and photographed every component of that track. I cut apart cars. I have 9 cars now.
So you race also?
Not at that track.
Okay.
I did in the past, but not here. I want to be one of these guys.
in my idealized movie, I'm one of these guys. And they have a car for me that one of these guys put together for me, and they want me to race against them. I know they're gonna teach me a lesson.
We're at the Hampton Film Festival. There was a track in the Hamptons that also kind of...
Bridgehampton, a super famous track. And a lot of people... Darryl Waltrip, Mario Andretti, Richard
How
Petty.
How pissed off are you that that's a golf course
Newman,
now?
You said yeah. Paul Newman before.
Paul Newman raced here almost every single weekend.
And you're annoyed about that, I'm sure.
No, yeah. Well,
One thing that's cool about going to that golf course, because I played it a couple times, is you drive up to the clubhouse and you're on... You don't realize it until you're halfway up that driveway. You're on the track. They
and
left that part
track.
Of the track.
It was a very special track because really straightaway, cool. It was about 1.75 miles. So for an open wheel car, you can go really fast on the straightaways. And the other thing with the straightaway was uphill.
Yeah.
So you really didn't know it was on the top of the hill. And typically there was a deer on the top of the hill. But you can go, you can go 160, 170 coming up that hill. And then you get to the top of the hill and there's the ocean.
Right.
Which you don't
gorgeous
want to see
views.
When you're racing
yeah.
a race car.
Amazing history out here in terms of race car driving. And you've chronicled it all in this film here at the Hamptons Film Festival. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. We're going to talk about a movie called, a documentary called This Changes Everything. And we have the director of that movie, Tom Donahue.
Hello.
And one of the principals in the film. I guess that's the best way to categorize, call you, Maria Geis. And the movie... which is could not. We're sitting here at the Hampton Film Festival.
You're a little coughed up just thinking about it. Yeah, it's
he's choked up.
It's very
we're
topical.
Here,
it's very timely.
We're at the unbelievably timely. This is Saturday, and whenever you're hearing this is the day that Brett Kavanaugh was officially confirmed to the Supreme Court. So this could not be a more timely discussion since this movie deals with Harvey Weinstein and the Me Too movement.
Well, let me say something about that. Is today in the screening, I was actually more emotionally moved with this audience because of what was happening today in Congress with the
right.
with the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. He kind of introduced a new layer of meaning for me, for the film.
And Maria, you started with this movement in 2011 and talking to the Directors Guild because you were one of the earlier proponents of the fact that women weren't being treated equally on the directing level. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. So I became a member of the Directors Guild of America in 1999. I've directed 2 feature films, some television, and I've written a number of feature screenplays that have gone into production. But when I stepped out of the doors of my graduate film school, UCLA, and stepped onto a professional playing field, I couldn't get any work at all. And I got some work in England, finally, but I couldn't get work in the United States.
Let me stop you. Could you get work in the United States if you were willing to sleep with somebody? Or were you hit on? Or were you like, did you have experiences like the Me Too victims?
I think, Hollywood is a very small industry based on personal relationships and reciprocity, where people, I'm going to do this for you, but what are you going to do for me? And typically, I think women directors aren't necessarily the first people that people want to go to sleep with. So sure, we all experienced a certain amount of sexual harassment just because that was the environment and so forth. You know, that wasn't my problem. That's not what my argument was about.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was willing to put up with a certain amount of
the old boys club,
but what I wasn't happy about was that I wasn't getting the jobs.
Right.
And ultimately, for me, it came down to the law, Title VII, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VII, demands for there to be equal employment opportunity, and we women weren't getting it. So we were looking at numbers of female director hires, like 14% episodic television, 4% studio features, and maybe 1% of commercials.
And to look at writers, in 2017, of the top 100 grossing films, 90% were actually written by men.
Tom, so it says here that your movie, you have interviews with such prominent actors as Meryl Streep and Jessica Chastain and Natalie Portman and Reese Witherspoon and Cate Blanchett, just to name a few. And are these women speaking out in your film, just since I haven't seen the film, about their experiences with sexual harassment in the film industry? Is that basically the like what the crux of...
No, sexual harassment is a symptom of workplace discrimination. We're very clear about that in the movie. So the movie is not about Me Too, and it's not about Time's Up, though they are brought up in the film.
Uh-huh.
But they come out of a place of, and Reese Witherspoon talks about this, since she was 14, she's been working since she was 14. She's been on sets of 150 men, where she's been the only woman on that set. And that creates a playing field in Hollywood where women are harassed and abused because there's no one to back them up. And as Rose McGowan says in the film, there's no human resources department for a woman to go to. And like Maria said, it's all who you know, and you have to be really careful about speaking up in Hollywood because you will not work again. So women will be made to do things that would be far worse, I think, than in any other industry, because the disparity in Hollywood is far worse than any other industry.
How would you describe the film? How would you describe the film? What is the message that you want to get across after somebody having seen it?
This isn't a film about just a few thousand women who can't get work in an American industry. Hollywood has an incredible global impact because 80% of all the media that the world sees is made in Hollywood. So what does that mean when 96% of the directors are men, 90% of the writers are men? What that means is one out of three characters on screen are women. 4 out of 5 narrators tend to be men. So a young girl watches media on screen and doesn't see career options for herself. She sees herself in a bikini as a little mermaid, being so happy that a man is in love with her. And this is time and time again across all media. This is how,
so how are we
going to
change that
on screen? Well, you should see the film, but I don't believe it can be changed.
Because it will change
without
everything?
Specific mandates. I think the government needs to actually step up and do what they do in every other industry since the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Title VII, which is you are not allowed to discriminate based on gender. And that is not enforced in Hollywood.
And, we tell the story about why. You think what happened today with Kavanaugh is going to make it easier or more difficult for change to be enacted in terms of...
I would actually argue the reason why we are in the position we are in right now is because little girls and little boys grow up and don't see little girls on screen doing anything more important than falling in love with a man.
Yeah, but before you go, and we're going to need to wrap this up because I know you're doing some other things here, but it seems to me like you could get 50-50 unity in the writing, let's say, of motion pictures, and they would still be about little girls who look up to and want to be the princess or the... I mean, female screenwriters will write about... will write action movies if that's what Hollywood wants just as easily as they can write another...
Hollywood actually...
So are you talking about like Wonder Woman or something like that?
Well, Wonder Woman's a good example actually of something that's moving in the right direction, but I'm saying that if you wanted to have more women writing and more women directing...
Captain Marvel also.
But let me just say, commercially, movies that are more diverse and have female leads actually do better at the box office than movies with male leads. In 2017, they made 38.1% more money, the top 100 films. So it's not even an economic argument. So if you did have 50-50, you would suddenly start to see the movies written and directed by women are actually making more money than the movies made
by men.
Well,
that'll solve it. That's the answer to my question.
That's why it's not...
I don't know.
By the way,
we'll see.
Because I'm sorry.
The unions are dominated by men.
Yes. Yes.
If equal employment opportunity law is enforced in Hollywood, then you will have equal numbers of men and women in these creative fields telling these stories. And then we will be seeing representations that are demographically equivalent. So then we'll be seeing stories that communicate to our girls and our women about in a more equal way.
It's better though in the indie world though, don't you think? I mean,
it's better
wherever there's less money.
I've seen a lot of women-centric movies directed by women that are, not about a woman looking for a man, that in the indie world, you know, maybe not in these $200 million budgeted Hollywood studios.
Well, Alan Alda says in the film, whenever a job becomes money-making, it becomes a man's job.
That's interesting. Wow.
We can only hope this documentary does in fact change something. In the meantime, it is called This Changes Everything. Tom and Maria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm looking forward to seeing this. This sounds fascinating.
Thank you.
Really. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Something like 70 million stray cats are let go every year. The Cat Rescuers is a documentary that tries to tell us if there's a happy ending to this story. One of the directors is Stephen Lawrence. He's with us now. Stephen, this is a crazy story. My wife feeds our feral cats in our yards every day out here in the Hamptons, and we have a cat at home. I've seen them in the Manhattan area, but I had no idea there were that many running around. How did it get there, and what are we doing to solve the problem?
Well, the figure you cited is a national figure.
Okay, just not just so good, because I was in Central Park, and I thought that's where half of them were.
No, I don't know what the count is in Central Park. In New York City, there are around 500,000, which is a huge number. There are more feral and abandoned cats in New York City than there are domestic cats. That gives you a sense of the magnitude of the problem.
So if they wanted to take over, they could come into the houses.
Are they in Manhattan?
You know the film Wolfen?
Yeah.
Okay. Are they in Manhattan?
Well, we're talking Staten Island, Queens. The majority of them are in the other boroughs, in Bronx, Staten Island, Brooklyn, and Queens. And, there are fewer places in Manhattan for cats to hide. Feral cats tend to congregate in alleys, backyards, abandoned buildings, wherever they can find shelter. So the problem is more prominent, especially in Brooklyn, where I live, and that's how the film got started.
And cats can get pregnant at, 4 months old, right?
Cats, yes. I think even younger. I think
really?
3 months. And a cat can become impregnated 30 minutes after giving birth.
Wow.
And
wow.
That accounts for the population explosion.
And the term catting around. Wow. I had no idea it was that. And how many litters can one kitten...
In a year, a cat can have 3 litters.
Wow. And so that's the problem. We got to fix these cats.
Right, right. So you've got this kind of Malthusian nightmare happening, and the city hasn't done much about it. So activists, people who love animals, have taken matters into their own hands, and that's what the film is about, for the people who are cat rescuers.
Are you a cat? I mean, how did you get involved in this? Did you have a few cats? And
well, my wife, who's sitting here to my right, and I moved into a house in a neighborhood in Brooklyn called Bay Ridge. Beautiful limestone house. We were delighted. Day after we moved in, we looked out our back door, and there was a mama cat and 3 kittens staring at us, begging to be fed. We didn't know what to do. We decided we're not going to give in. We're not going to start a feeding frenzy here and be responsible for these cats. We have 2 indoor cats. We had no experience with feral cats. Eventually, Helen broke down and said, we've got to feed them.
I said, Helen, how many days in was that?
Maybe about 5 days in, I burst into tears. The kittens were covered with fleas. They were starving. And then another mother cat and 3 kittens showed up. And
word got out.
And we said, we just moved here. To hell with this. Let the people who have been living here deal with it. We're not going to.
But there was a tipping point.
Do you have experience as a filmmaker? I mean,
yes. I'm an experienced documentary filmmaker, veteran documentary filmmaker.
But
I wasn't initially thinking about this as a film. We had a domestic problem that we had to solve.
And he didn't want me to feed them. And I said, I promise if I feed them, I'm going to find homes for these kittens.
How'd that plan go?
it went pretty well. But there was...
It took 6 months, and one of the rescuers in the film has one of the kittens grown up.
And that's how you met that rescuer, I'm guessing.
I met her in the film.
But the point about this is that we were completely ignorant, and so was everybody on our block. There were several people who were feeding these cats, and they were multiplying like crazy. And we had no idea what you do when you're faced with a situation. So we had to get educated. We had to learn about trap, neuter, return, which is a humane way of controlling and reducing the population of feral cats. And as we got educated, we started to meet people in the rescue community. And these are the people who taught us the tricks of the trade. And eventually what happened is that, and it was mostly Helen's work, we trapped over 35 cats on our block, got them neutered, and return to their colonies. We educated everybody on our block, and we completely ended the whole population explosion. There hasn't been a kitten on our block in over 3 years now. Anyway, in the process of learning about the problem in the city, I thought, well, there's a film here, because there is a significant animal welfare problem. The city isn't doing much about it, and we had begun to meet people who are activists and rescuers who are doing amazing work, and they're invisible. They're invisible to almost all New Yorkers. I decided...
They're very good at hiding. I had no idea that there were this many cats. We're in the Hamptons. I wonder how many stray cats there are around here.
They're all at my house. Trust me.
Are there a lot of cats around?
I'd like to
there
meet
are,
your wife.
There are... Be careful. Be careful what you wish for. But she will teach your wife how to handle the
problem.
Note to
Mrs. McCuddy, you're not meeting this woman.
Yes, are there a lot of cats out here in the Hamptons?
I think there are, and tomorrow, as part of our panel discussion, there will be representatives from a shelter in East Hampton and another one in Southampton.
But they're good at hiding, like unlike the deer population out here, which is a real problem
right.
if you're driving. I mean, they're not hiding. The deer are all over the place. I don't see cats around. I mean, I believe you, but I mean, you know, they...
Cats do have to hide. They have to hide for self-preservation. And so
that's 70 million. It's a lot of hiding. I mean, that's a lot.
They don't hide at our house. It's like the Côte d'Azur in the summer. They're lounging.
Well, yeah,
their backs.
How many cats do you have?
We have 10 that are part of our colony now.
Wow.
We call it Club Med for cats.
Not make too fine a point. This is the problem solved now. You've solved it on your block, and you have 10 cats.
Right. But the film is not about our block and how we solved our problem.
Right. But you did a little rescuing on your own.
Yes, we did. And the film is about four people in the rescue community in Brooklyn, and they're representative of hundreds of people who are doing this work.
Wow.
Day and night. And when I say day and night, I'm serious. A lot of these people are up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning trapping or rescuing cats, and they're working late into the night. And sometimes these cats are very hard to catch. One of our characters, Sassy, spent over a year trying to trap one black cat in Coney Island who kept getting pregnant over and over again and sadly delivering dead kittens.
Sassy is the name of the black cat, or Sassy is the name of the...
Sassy is the name of one of the rescuers.
Okay, okay. Sounds like a cat name.
The cat they were trying to rescue was Janet. So it's very ironic. The names are completely mixed up. No, I'm...
Anyway, the movie is The Cat Rescuers. Bill had a cat.
I had a cat for 14 years. And her ashes are actually in a little urn on top of my bookcase where she used to nap. So Mrs. Peel, her name was. And she was black and white, like the Avengers episodes that I used to watch as a kid.
Emma Peel.
That's right. So,
was she a rescue cat?
Yes, she was, actually. She was living in a dumpster prior to me. And I was told she would never sit in my lap because she just wasn't used to humans. And, of course, I bribed her by putting little treats in my lap. And
I've seen his apartment, and she yearned for that dumpster after she got rescued. Hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen
so
Lawrence
okay.
And your lovely wife, Helen.
Helen Garrett.
Lawrence, Garrett. Not Edie Gourmet.
No, it's Helen Garrett.
There you go.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Stephen. So First Man opens up. It's opening up. And it's Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong. And it was directed by Damien Chazelle, who is actually here out at the Hampton Film Festival. The movie is showing out here at the Hampton Film Festival. And Ryan Gosling reunites with Damien. Their last movie together was La La Land.
And his wife is played by Claire Foy.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting choice.
From The Queen.
With an American accent.
You boys don't know what you're doing.
And
you're gonna kill
I have to
my
say
husband.
That... Visually, it was like I took a trip to the moon. I mean, it was, they really put you inside that capsule. I mean, unlike movies like, let's say, The Right Stuff, which I love, or Apollo 13, which I also love, I mean, the camera was really from the perspective of the astronauts, and you really kind of felt, I mean, the camera shakes like the rocket shakes, and it was really great in that respect. There's a shot that I loved when Neil Armstrong before Buzz Aldrin is the second man on the moon, he's alone on the moon. He's
Buzz,
the first
if
guy
that's
on the
your
moon,
name.
And he just kind of looks around, and he's the only person who's ever been on the surface of this other
well, allegedly.
Body. What?
Allegedly.
Right. And there's this. The camera just sweeps around and just looks at the barren, vast emptiness of this thing, and it's just great.
And there's no monolith, right? There's no monolith.
No, there's no monolith from the nice Kubrick reference from 2001: A Space Odyssey. But nonetheless, I would say that all that said, Neil Armstrong was kind of a robotic, emotionless person, and I felt an emotional disconnect from the story to some extent. You know, there was the director did manage to generate some suspense, even though we know the mission was successful, that Apollo 11 did successfully land on the moon and return safely. Buzz Aldrin came off as kind of like a goofball.
I worked with Buzz for a morning.
Did Buzz, really? If that's really his name. Remember that Simpsons?
He did a radio tour, and he is a character.
Yeah, he's a total character. Well, he was on Fox News a couple of times.
When you see the movie, he's right, all these other guys are buttoned down and just Corey all business, plays. And this guy's just like, there's a great line in it when he said something, then all the astronauts look at him, and he goes, hey, I'm just speaking my mind, and Neil Armstrong goes, well, maybe you shouldn't, you know?
You know, remember who played him in the film? Because he just said it, but I bet you didn't hear him.
I know who played him in the film. I forget the guy's name.
Corey Stoll. He just
Corey
said
Stoll
it.
From Ant-Man.
Here's
from
another Ant-Man. Moment you just missed, Neil. Brought to you by LaCroix.
There
the
you
delicious
go.
Water. Right. Hey, we had fun here.
Here's,
at the,
here's our
Hampton's
Bill,
Bill
Bregoli moment of the week. So, Bill, you liked First Man, didn't you?
Sure. That's
strap yourself
you.
In.
That's next to you.
I so another fabulous year at the Hamptons Film Festival.
That's right. It's this is what year, Phil? What is the Claire Ann? What is this is the what we're on the air. What is the this
we're
is the 20th, the 19th, the 21st?
This is the 26th, this but how many have we been coming out here?
Oh, at least
like
five.
Six or five?
Five. We've, four, done, the, we've done the show for four
Claire
or five.
Ann went, yeah, it's been that long. Okay. Yeah, thanks.
That's right. Well, anyway, I'm Neil Rosen. You can reach me at Neil Rosen Apples if you want to tweet me. Bill McCuddy.
At Bill McCuddy on Twitter.
And try to dig around on Google and find Bill Bregoli on Facebook.
He's in a space capsule somewhere.
He'd love to hear from you.
Hamptons Film Festival always takes good care of us. And we're at the 1770 House this year, the backyard, where we had great access to all the people. And so thanks to David Nugent and all the folks involved with the festival.
And Frank PR. And thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. We'll sit around talking movies with you again next week.